In 2014, The Atlantic published an article as a thought experiment. It was one of those what-if articles. And it was asking the question, what if the British had won the Revolutionary War? What would the world look like today if the other side had won? The article surveyed a number of these what-if kinds of books. There's an entire genre of literature dedicated to this. I read a book several years ago that asked the what-if scenario. What if the United States had never entered into the war in Europe? We defeated Japan. We did not enter into the war in Europe. Hitler took over Europe. What would happen? What would the world be like today if Hitler had actually been able to conquer Europe? Well, sometimes you and I live with a what-if faith. See, it's easy for us to fall into the mindset that God merely allows history to play out however it will, but don't worry, God's really, really smart, and he's really clever, and he somehow can manage every single time to make good things happen, even out of the worst circumstances. I mean, his plan B is really, really good, right? So is his plan C and D and E and F and G and H. But what if, see what I did there? But what if God doesn't have a plan B? What if God only has a plan A? What if God has zero backup plans, zero alternate options, zero what if contingencies? What if God's plan is actually an all or nothing plan? A plan that never, ever fails. We're in John 11 again today. Last week we saw Jesus had just been to the city of Bethany at the request of Mary and Martha on account of their brother Lazarus. He was sick, and then shortly after, he dies. But Jesus, knowing exactly what he was doing when he delayed his trip to Bethany, planned all along to raise Lazarus from the dead. After Lazarus had been buried for 4 days, Jesus arrived, raised him from the dead, all according to plan. Well, the plan continues in verse 45 of John 11. Many of the Jews, therefore, based on the heels of this raising of Lazarus, many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. Jesus, therefore, no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness, to a town called Ephraim. And there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think, that he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him. Little history lesson. Whenever Rome, ancient Rome, conquered another nation, the empire was largely okay with that conquered nation having a measure of self-governance. There were two broad requirements for this. You can do what you please so long as you, A, don't riot, and B, pay your taxes. Do those two things, do what you want. You can be a free people if you want to call it that. Just don't riot, pay your taxes. See, Rome believed it was spreading peace everywhere it expanded, right? So long as a conquered people did not disturb that peace, Rome was content to let them essentially govern themselves. Now, there were, of course, actual Roman colonies, cities that were actually thoroughly Roman even in their government. Ancient Philippi, for example, Paul wrote a letter to the Philippians. Ancient Philippi was a thoroughly Roman city started by the Romans for Romans. Ancient Jerusalem was not a Roman city. There was a governor placed over the Roman province of Judea, of which Jerusalem was a part. Now, the people there were largely able to do as they pleased, but only if they continued to abide by the two main rules. Don't disturb the peace and do pay your taxes. If a conquered nation were to rebel against either of these, they would quickly lose their right to self-govern. Now, when we read our text in light of this concern, we see it. John tells us this, that in response to Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, many Jews believed in him. I mean, how could they not? I mean, how could one deny the reality that a miracle had taken place? I mean, many who had witnessed it believed, but not all. I mean, no one could deny that a miracle had taken place. I mean, not all believed what the miracle said about Jesus. No one denied that it was a miracle. They denied what it meant. In verse 46, John tells us that some went to the Pharisees and they told on Jesus, right? They tattled to the Pharisees what had happened. You know, the bad stuff, like raising a guy from the dead. I mean, the horror, right? John says the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council together. This probably refers to the Sanhedrin. Now, lots of cities in Judea would have had local Sanhedrins. A Sanhedrin was a governing council. It usually consisted of 21 judges. They were like the city council. They governed the city. But then there was the great Sanhedrin that had 71 judges. They were much like our Supreme Court. They were the final decision makers in Judea under Roman authority, of course. Now, since this event took place in Bethany, which is only a couple miles from Jerusalem, it's very likely John means the great Sanhedrin. Now, what's surprising here is he says the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together, and they're clearly united in their purpose for meeting. Now, most of the chief priests would have been Sadducees. The Pharisees were a very small group in the first century. In fact, during this time, there would have been perhaps 7,000 of them in the entire country. The Sadducees clearly outnumbered the Pharisees at this time. And both groups were represented on the council, but they were at odds on nearly every issue. In fact, they were at opposite ends of the spectrum politically. Watching them during normal course of work on the Sanhedrin would have been like watching Democrats and Republicans in Congress, right? Sometimes you vote no for legislation you really like because the other party proposed it. Can't get them the credit. Well, these two groups assembled together to discuss what to do about Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, along with all of his other amazing things. You know, bad things, terrible things, like healing the sick and casting out demons and feeding hungry people and teaching them to love their neighbors as themselves. I mean, think of the question they're there to discuss. What are we to do with Jesus since he performs so many miracles? That only ever help people, mind you. Well, you know, today's skeptics often deny the reality of the miracles he performed, claiming that the biblical writers merely made them up. But notice that the scribes or the chief priests and the Pharisees don't deny that the miracles actually happened. In fact, it's precisely because no one could deny miracles that they were so upset. I mean, think of what they're saying. What are we to do since everybody sees these miracles and everybody can affirm these are really miracles? These things are really happening and there's no other way to explain how they're happening. If we let him go on like this, everybody's going to believe in him. And we can't have that. See, the problem as they see it is that Jesus is gaining more followers. Now, as those who are reading this gospel know, many of those followers are really only in it for the miracles and not because of genuine faith in Jesus. The members of the Sanhedrin don't know that. They exaggerate a bit, but they are concerned if Jesus continues doing all these great and wonderful, I mean, terrible things that help people, crowds are going to get bigger and bigger. Why is that a problem, though? What does it matter if he attracts lots of followers? I mean, if Jesus keeps healing people, that's good for Rome, right? I mean, healthy people can work harder, and the harder you work, the more money you earn, the more money you earn, the more taxes you can pay. Why would Rome be upset? Well, verse 48, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. If we let Jesus continue performing miracles and his crowds of followers continue to grow, the Romans will notice. And if there's one thing the Romans cannot stand, it's a challenge to their authority. Now, we're going to see this in chapter 18 when Jesus is on trial before the Roman governor Pilate. Pilate asks him directly if he, Jesus, claims to be a king. You see, only the emperor could grant a person the title of king. I mean, there was one small exception. It was just kind of widely recognized that poets and crazy people could claim to be king all they wanted because nobody ever took them seriously. And as we'll see in chapter 18, Pilate will seek to release Jesus from custody and will actually call him the king of the Jews. And not because he thinks he's a poet. Well, remember that right after Jesus fed the 5,000, right? They tried to take him. The 5,000 tried to take Jesus and force him to be king. That 5,000, by the way, is only men, right? John says there are also women and children. That crowd was easily 20,000. But John tells us that this also took place around the Passover when Jews would have been traveling to the area from all over the known world. Thousands upon thousands of Jews would travel to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. A crowd of 5,000 men could easily swell to several times that number very, very quickly. That's a small army. Now we start to see the problem. What they don't know, though, is Jesus did not come to overthrow Rome. He wasn't interested in starting a revolution. So Jesus withdrew from them. Their fear is that Jesus' miracles will attract the attention of Rome, and then Rome would eliminate their place and their nation. That is, they would eliminate the Sanhedrin as a governing body and remove the measure of self-governance the Jews had. See, the council members would lose their position and status in Jewish society. So now their opposition is personal. He's threatening them directly. Well, one of the members of the Sanhedrin is really angry at this point. He's angry, actually, with his fellow council members. Caiaphas was high priest that year, and he addressed the council in anger. He told them they were ignorant. They knew nothing. They were clueless. He says they should have figured out by now that it's better for one guy to die than for all of us to die. Oh, and in case you're wondering, that man should be Jesus, geniuses. I mean, he's angry. He is ticked that they haven't figured this out yet. See, for Caiaphas, it's really personal. However, inasmuch as Caiaphas was speaking vitriol and hatred toward Jesus, God was at work powerfully. Look at verse 51 again. He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, that is the nation of the Jews, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad, all nations, right? So, from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. I can't help but think that John is poking fun at Caiaphas here. Caiaphas tells the Sanhedrin, you guys are dumb, you're stupid, you don't know anything. But John tells us that it was Caiaphas who didn't know anything, including what God was doing. See, both Jews and Greeks in the first century believed that a person could accidentally speak on behalf of God without even knowing that they were speaking for God. Here, John affirms that this is exactly what Caiaphas was doing. Even in his ignorance, he is speaking truth about the plan of God, though Caiaphas thinks it's his plan. John says, from that day on, they made plans to put Jesus to death. Again, it is Caiaphas who knows nothing. I mean, from that day on, like, Caiaphas, you're a priest. You're a high priest this year. You should know what Isaiah wrote a long time ago. Isaiah said, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds, we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who consider that he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. This was prophesied 700 years before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin made their plans to carry this out. I mean, the Apostle Peter knew this on the day of Pentecost when he declared this to the people of Jerusalem. He said, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." Now, whose idea was it for Jesus to die? It was God's idea. It was the very reason the Son of God put on flesh and lived among us, so that he could die for the sins of his people. Why did this happen, though? Why did he actually die? He was given into their hands. He was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. Now, you got to know that the word foreknowledge here does not mean knowing in advance. That's how we tend to understand it in English. It has the idea of predetermining. The reason God knows the future is God has predetermined the future. It's pretty easy to know what's going to happen when you control what happens. God predetermined Jesus would die according to his definite plan that Jesus would die. See, they thought that Jesus was a problem, and the way to get rid of the problem was to get rid of Jesus, but death could never get rid of Jesus because Jesus is Lord. That means life and death are in his hands. See, death was never going to get rid of Jesus, because Jesus had come to get rid of death. I mean, didn't the signs and wonders he performed tell them that? Think of the immediate context. This is right on the heels of something amazing. Jesus raised a man from the dead. A man was dead. Really dead. Dead and buried for 4 days. Dead. Not passed out and waiting to come to. Dead. Dead, dead. Not mostly dead. He came out of his tomb because Jesus told him to, and he wasn't dead anymore. If that doesn't blow your mind, I don't know what will. How exactly do you think killing a man like Jesus will stop Jesus? I mean, think that through. This guy can raise the dead, so let's kill him. But let's step back a bit. Peter says on Pentecost that they saw the mighty works and wonders and signs Jesus performed. The Sanhedrin acknowledges, yes, this guy performs miracles. How in the world do you think you can catch a guy who can perform miracles, let alone kill him? He can literally walk across the lake to get away from you. Right? Caiaphas was right. They know nothing at all. They made foolish plans to put Jesus to death, but they don't know that the only way they can put him to death is because Jesus will allow himself to be put to death. Notice Peter's words again. Jesus was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, not the plans of Caiaphas and his minions. Now, John says in verse 54 that Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but instead went to a town nearby called Ephraim. Ephraim was about 12 miles northeast of Jerusalem. Listen, Jesus is not afraid of being caught by the Jews. He avoids walking openly among the Jews, but not out of fear. He's merely controlling the timing of events. It's not quite yet time to die. Verse 55. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Now, John has mentioned a couple different Passovers. Right? This is like the third Passover that he talks about. Jesus' ministry was at least 2 years, probably less than four. One of those Passovers was in chapter 2, and the other was mentioned briefly in chapter 6. Now, John is being very intentional here. We've seen that throughout his gospel. He's very intentional in the words he includes. Many were in Jerusalem ahead of Passover in order to go through ritual purification rites so that they could eat the Passover meal. They're looking for Jesus, and they're asking whether Jesus would show up early like they did. Why did they show up early? To go through the purification rituals. Will Jesus come and do the same thing? Well, why would he? I need to pull in a couple threads here so we can see the whole tapestry, right? Think back to chapter 2, Jesus' very first miracle. He's at a wedding in Cana where they run out of wine. Now, in an ancient culture like this where it's an honor-shame culture, this would bring great shame on the bride and groom. So Jesus' mother comes to him. She knows a little about him and asks him to do something about it, right? You can fix this. You can prevent our friends, our dear friends, from experiencing deep shame. Well, Jesus turns water into wine, right? That's his first miracle. But do you remember what he used? He used stone purification jars. See, these large jars made of stone were believed to remain ritually pure, ritually clean, so they would be filled with water and then used for ritual washing. That's a holy activity. You don't wash your hands before dinner with these jars. You need ritually clean water if you want to have ritually clean hands. See, these jars were not to be used for something common and ordinary as a wedding feast, yet that is exactly what Jesus uses them for. Let me pull in one more thread. I want you to notice something else John says in our text. He says it twice. He'll say it again in chapter 18. In verse 49, Caiaphas is speaking, and John introduces him by saying, "But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year." And then he says in verse 51, Caiaphas didn't speak of his own accord, but being high priest that year. Anyone know how long Caiaphas was high priest? 18 years. 18 years he was high priest, the longest serving high priest in the first century. John does not use words unnecessarily. Why does he repeat that a man who spent 18 years as high priest was high priest that year? What is going on that year that he would highlight this? See, what Caiaphas doesn't know, but what John knew when he wrote this gospel, is that that year was the last year Caiaphas would serve as high priest. Now, the historian Josephus tells us Caiaphas was appointed in the year 18, so 12 years prior to this, which means he's going to serve in the formal role of high priest for another 6 years after this. But he was no longer high priest of God's people. He retained the title, but he was no longer high priest. He was that year, but that year is nearly over. See, that year is going to end on Passover. Jesus knows the time for his death is near, so he is avoiding being among the Jews. He will die on Passover, so he is controlling the timing of his death. See, his death is what ushers in the new covenant. He is the sacrifice that brings in the new covenant. And think of it. Years, decades later, when the book of Hebrews was written, the temple in Jerusalem was still standing. The priesthood was still there functioning. They were still offering their daily sacrifices. And yet the author of Hebrews would say this about those very priests. He said, "The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he," that is Jesus, "holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever." Remember, how do you kill a guy who can raise the dead, right? "Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest." What's he like? Holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He, Jesus, has no need, like all those other priests, to offer sacrifices daily. First for his own sins, and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. A few chapters later, the author says, "Every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins." But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God because the day was done, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. I'm just going to add, it's not a manuscript. You ever starting to question and doubt and wonder if God could ever love a sinner like you? One sacrifice, he has perfected for all time all those people who trust in him. That's good news. That's good news. That's gospel truth right there. See, Caiaphas was high priest that year, and even though he'd retained the title for another 6 years, Jesus became high priest that year, and every year since. And because he can never die again, he remains our high priest. Unlike all those other priests, the same priest who had to offer daily sacrifices that could never take away the sins of God's people, when Jesus offered himself as a sacrifice by that single perfect sacrifice, he has perfected for all time God's people. Man, this is good news. Now, when the people are in the temple in verse 56, asking whether Jesus would come. Remember, they're there early for ritual purification. Will Jesus come now? Is he going to show up and be a faithful Jew? The reality is, he doesn't need to come to the feast. And he certainly doesn't need to come early in order to purify himself, because he's already a pure and spotless sacrifice. He's simply waiting until the time of his sacrifice is ready. Jesus is merely implementing the plan he and his Father had initiated long, long before this. The truth of it all is that God sending his only Son to become one of us and to die for the sins of his people is the plan God had all along. And by all along, I mean before the very foundation of the earth. Before the world was created, this was his plan. Paul told the Ephesian church that they were chosen in Christ before the foundation of the world. He told them that same letter a few chapters later that God's plan was to reveal his glory through his church, and he called it God's eternal purpose. He said to the Galatians that Jesus was born in the fullness of time. To say that another way, when God's plan was in place, he sent his only Son. Caiaphas and the entire council who chose to condemn Jesus unjustly were oblivious to God's plan, even though Jesus demonstrated his plan to them everywhere he went, in both his teaching and in his miracles. And here's the incredible thing. God's plan cannot be thwarted even when evil people do evil things. That's good news. This is gospel. Think back again to what Peter said on the day of Pentecost. He told the people in Jerusalem that Jesus was crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. Right? The murder of Jesus was the greatest act of evil and rebellion against God ever perpetrated by humans. Yet why did it happen? Well, clearly lawless men chose to do evil. They chose to murder Jesus. But even their choice to kill Jesus was according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. God didn't make them choose to do evil, yet God used their evil according to his plan. See, evil thought it could stop God's plan by killing Jesus, but evil got played. Evil got played because God's plan was for the death of Jesus. It was the only way for Jesus to offer himself as the sacrifice that takes away the sins of the world. Evil got played. We're going to kill you, Jesus. Now, hear what this means for you and for me. It means we can trust God in all circumstances because, as he demonstrated so clearly with his plan for Jesus, his plan to save his people, he has already planned out our lives. I love how Edward Clink put it. He said, "The God who created all things also controls all things. They are his things, after all. Even the evil intentions and actions of his enemies. This is your God, Christian, the one in whom you have placed your trust. Your faith is not in the systems and institutions of humanity, nor in your own ability to devise a plan, but in the God who controls them all, in the mysterious but gracious plan of God for you and the world. For we know that in all things God works for the good, and for this reason we trust in him no matter the initial forecast. This is what we must pursue: faith in him. Caiaphas wanted political freedom, so he led the Sanhedrin to make plans to kill Jesus. But Caiaphas knew nothing, including the fact that in just 40 years, a Roman army was going to march into Jerusalem and destroy the city, including their beloved temple. He also didn't know that the temple was no longer needed, because Jesus is our new high priest, and he doesn't need a physical temple in which to offer sacrifices, because his body is both the temple and the sacrifice offered once for all time. See, what you and I need more than anything else is Jesus. That means we ought not spend our time pursuing autonomy and self-government as our highest end. Yes. Right. We ought to spend our time seeking to be a servant of King Jesus. Yes. Not a whole lot of self-autonomy there. He is Lord. Now, whether God's plan includes political freedom and self-government or not, whether public assemblies in the name of Jesus remain free or are outlawed, whether we can publicly confess together that Jesus is Lord, or it comes about that doing so may land us in jail, Jesus is Lord. He remains Lord. There's no law you could pass that undoes that fact. If his plan includes suffering for us, then the careful and precise control God showed over the life and death and resurrection of Jesus ought to encourage us that his plan for our lives is firmly in his control, come what may. See, there are no what-if scenarios in God's timeline. There's no alternate plan. There's no, I want to do this, but I got thwarted, I'll try this. That doesn't happen with God. This is why we can trust him with that unexpected medical issue that is deeply concerning. This is why we can trust him with that wayward child. This is why we can trust him when our income drops and the bills pile up. This is why we can trust him when that relationship turns rocky. This is why we can trust him with our very lives. God allows these problems to come that we may have opportunity to develop our faith in him and in his character and in his promises, because he has already shown himself faithful in his story.